You started writing for what were technically called the pulps, or we always called the pulps, right?
That's right.
And you made the transition to the mainstream, but you began Galaxy, and you were writing for pulp magazines, and then you made this transition.
Well, I didn't really make the transition. It happened inside me. Yeah. So I was writing quality stories and I didn't know it. I wasn't writing pulp stories, but I was having trouble with weird tales. I published, 20 stories there, but I had a lot of trouble with them because I was writing quality stories and they didn't want them. They wanted the old-fashioned ghosts. They wanted Scrooge and Marley all over. They wanted Edgar Allan Poe. Well, I couldn't be Edgar Allan Poe. I couldn't be Dickens, even at his best, or his worst, or whatever you want to call it. So I had fights with my editors because I was doing quality work and I didn't know it. All those stories that appeared in Weird Tales 60 years ago are part of the books I'm publishing today. They're all quality stuff. But I was so removed from myself, I couldn't see what I was doing. They're very original, very new. So I was making a half cent a word, or a penny a word, or a penny and a half on the rich weeks in my life. So my income was usually around $20 a week, and I wrote 52 stories a year, one every week, because I knew I had to write a lot of quantity in order to get the quality someday. And so that was good. I put myself on a diet. But then after a while, the Weird Tales people rejected one of my stories, Homecoming, and on a hunch, I sent it to Mademoiselle magazine, and they held it for months because they didn't know what to do with it either. And they finally wrote to me and said, well, we thought of ways of changing your story, but we realized we can't do that, so we'll change the magazine to fit the story. So they put together a big October issue and put Homecoming in the center with an illustration by Charles Adams, who was just starting his career about his Adams family in the pages of The New Yorker. But at the same time, I submitted some stories to Planet Stories, a pulp magazine, and the editor wrote back and said, this is too good for us. If you don't mind, we're going to send it over to Collier's for you. The editors of Planet became my agents, so they made the transition for me, and sent my story to Collier's. So isn't that wonderful? And they said, if Collier's doesn't take this, we'll print it. But it's really too good for us. So Collier's rejected it, and they published it. That was the beginning of my getting more courage to submit the bigger magazine. So the transition was unconscious. Yeah.
You said in a couple places that Fahrenheit 451 was the only science fiction book you wrote.
That's right.
Could you explain what that means?
Well, the best way to illustrate is this. I did a play, The Martian Chronicles, on the stage here on Wilshire Boulevard at the El Rey Theater about 20 years ago. And I had all my Martians on the stage there with their golden masks and all the dramatic scenes from the book. Well, during rehearsals one night, I walked four blocks west to the County Museum of Art, and in there was the traveling exhibit of King Tut, And I walked in. They had the doors open that night late. And I walked in at 8 o'clock, and I looked down at King Tut's sarcophagus and his golden mask. I said, my God, that's my Martian. And I went back to the theater, and I looked up on the stage at my Martians. I said, my God, that's King Tut, So the thing that happened when I was three, King Tut came out of the tomb. I saw pictures of him in the papers. I saw one or two pictures in color. There wasn't much color photography in 1923, but here and there. And I fell in love with Egypt and with King Tut. And he remained a love through my life, along with the Norse Eddas, Greek myths, Roman myths. So the Martian Chronicles is an accumulation of Egyptology, Greek mythology, Roman, and my love of Valhalla and Odin. Huh? They're all there embedded in that book. It's a fantasy book. And so much of my stuff is based on my love of fairy tales and mythology from my childhood. So it's not science fiction at all.
But Fahrenheit 451 is the one you would consider science fiction.
Yeah, because, see, science fiction is the art of the possible. Fantasy is the art of the impossible. So everything in the Martian Chronicles is impossible. There is no Mars like that. There are no cities. There is no atmosphere. When they introduced me out at Caltech, they said, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, here is the man who put an atmosphere on Mars." And the students love it, and they accept me, huh? And even though it's completely unscientific. But Fahrenheit, you see, is completely possible, and we've seen it happening in the 50 years since the book was published, with the invention, super invention of TV, the computer, the internet, the interrelation between people on the screen and people in the living rooms. So we've seen a diminution of knowledge. We've seen the destruction of education. And now our big problem the next few years is to teach reading and writing in kindergarten again. That's where it's got to start.
And 451 really deals more than your other books with political reality, with the totalitarianism.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, but not self-consciously. Anything that's intellectual is self-conscious. The intellect is there to instruct us after the act, and sometimes before the act, but you got to be careful not to destroy your life. Huh? You can't think of everything ahead of time. You got to do it. Huh? I've got a saying I use in my lectures: jump off the cliff and build your wings on the way down. Huh? Now, that doesn't apply to everything. With certain kinds of love affairs, you got to be careful who you go to bed with. So there's where you do a little thinking ahead of time. But otherwise, if you are on the verge of a great love affair, whether it's a book or a person, you go to bed and think late that night or the next morning, how was that? Do I want this to go on? Huh? Is this person right for me? Before it's too late, you know, your intellect says, you better head for the door. Or, no, let's keep experimenting, huh? And maybe you fall in love forever, which happened with me and Maggie. But at first, you're very fearful, of course, because you don't know where you're going. So with books and any artistic creation, you've got to do it. And then your intellect can take over after, because there's plenty of time then for you to stand off and say, well, this is wrong, that's wrong, or it's okay, a little touch here and there. And the older you get, the better you are, so you don't have to intellectualize as much. So, but people, unfortunately, in all walks of life, in the colleges and in the studios, you see, you have intellectualizing. In the colleges, they want to tear things apart and figure out how they work much too much. And in the studios, the same things happens at a different level. They say, well, let's not do the screenplay this way. You got to do this. And you say, well, then you get a group of people in trying to make a screenplay. And it's rare. It's a rare thing when it happens. It can happen more often with comedy, because comedy is dependent on all kinds of acrobatics and jokes being flung into the air. And if they're good, they're wonderful and you're entertained. But I've discovered there's very little difference between studios and colleges, because people do too much thinking. But the thinking has got to come late and not early. Huh?